March 2021, Meeting of Parliament, Order of Proceedings. We continue with answers to oral questions. We commence with question number 836. The questioner is the Honourable K. Asoparvi.
Mr. Speaker, will the government extend the regime providing tax concessions to businesses available for the modification of properties so as to make these more disability-friendly when the present scheme runs out? And is government prepared to put this permanently in place and extend the scope to private individuals and internal works to homes?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government is considering extending the measure in time, but not making it permanent. The extension would arise from the fact that works may not have been undertaken during the pandemic period. It would, however, make no policy sense to make the concession permanent. The extension to private dwellings is also under consideration.
Mr. Speaker, can I just probe what the Chief Minister has said about it not making policy sense to make it permanent? Can he sort of expand on that issue?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman knows that the requirement to modify property for the purposes of ensuring compliance with the Disability Act is already in our law. And the purpose of the tax concession is to promote that the works that are relevant should be done now when they are not works which are required. The position is that upon any refurbishment, it is necessary to ensure that the refurbishment complies with the new rules, and in any new build, it is necessary to ensure that the property, when a new build, complies with the rules. So the purpose of the concession is to promote that people should now, because of the concession, decide to make the reforms to the buildings, so the internal structure of a building, that are required by the legislation. If we simply make this permanent, then, of course, there's no incentive to act now. People would then, whenever they decide to refurbish, have the benefit of the concession. And the policy behind the tax concession is to try and promote that work being done sooner rather than later.
Can I ask on the extension of the scope to private individuals, which he said was under consideration, is would we be right in thinking that if an announcement is going to be made in that respect, it would be made at budget time?
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir.
Next question.
Question number 837, the Honourable K. Asoparvi.
Mr. Speaker, will the government be filling the AA vacancies it advertised in September 2019?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, these have been filled.
Next question.
Question number 839, the Honourable K. Asoparvi.
Mr. Speaker, how many asylum applications and appeals against asylum decisions have been filed under the Asylum Regulations 2008 during the period 1st of January 2010 to the 31st of December 2020, broken down by years and numbers of applications and appeals?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Asylum, Mr. Speaker. I will answer this question with questions 840 and 841, and I will answer them on the basis of applications in Gibraltar for asylum.
Question number 840, the Honourable K. Asoparvi.
I'm not sure what he means by that, but I'm sure he'll illuminate. I'm not asking for asylum yet. How many applications for exemption under Section 12(2) of the Immigration, Asylum and Refugee Act have been filed in the period 1st of January 2012 to the 31st of December 2020, broken down by year, and how many of those remained pending at the 31st of December 2020?
Mr. Speaker, the throwaway remark was about the reports in newspapers about Gibraltar being used for the processing of asylum applications to other nations.
We need to...
So, yes. Oh, there's one more. Oh, I see.
Question number 841, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, how many applications for naturalisation as a British Overseas Territory citizen have been filed in the period 1st of January 2012 to 31st of December 2020, broken down by year, and how many of those remained pending at 31st of December 2020?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested is set out in the schedule that I now hand over.
Mr. Speaker, can I ask about, on question 840, which is the question about applications for exemption from section 12, I mean, that's about, for anyone listening out there, that's about a sort of waiver application that needs to be filed under the Immigration Act, which is usually a prelude to making a naturalization application in many cases. Can I understand the figures on the second column? Because, so for example, looking at the period 2012, because my question asks how many applications have been filed, by broken down by year, and how many were pending at 31st December 2020. Is it right that in respect of the year 2012, there are still 8 years later, five applications pending? And is it right that in respect of the year 2013, there are still four applications pending, and in respect of 2015, for example, there are still 20 applications pending? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is correct.
And would the Chief Minister comment on that? Because obviously I understand that insofar as 2020 or even perhaps 2019 is concerned, there would be a backlog of applications for a variety of reasons and processing and so on. But when someone has made an application 4, 5, or even 9 years ago, in 2012, how is it justifiable that those applications are still pending?
Well, it's very simply justifiable, Mr. Speaker. If the Honourable Gentleman looks at the number of Section 12 applications, we were dealing in 2012 with 309. I would say that is the sort of backlog that I found when I was elected. And if there are five still pending, it is because there may have been either deficiencies in the application or there may have been reasons why the decision was not to grant the application. And we will have gone back to the applicants in all instances, and we will either have got back from the applicants further information and have had to go back to them again and again, or we will have deferred the application rather than refuse it after consideration with the applicant of whether there should be a deferral so that they can cure the problems, or whether they would prefer a refusal so that they have the certainty of refusal, or whether they can then make the decision to challenge a refusal. They can also, of course, challenge a deferral if it isn't a deferral that's been agreed. But that is the sort of process that you go through, where you seek more information, where you try and tease out that information where it's not otherwise forthcoming in order to be able to deal with the numbers. if you look at the column of pending applications, Mr. Speaker, other than for 2019-2020, where there is a backlog which we have to clear, and not just in relation to Section 12 applications, but in relation to so much more that I know is on my pending tray as we come into this period post-pandemic, I hope, we have actually, what I would say to the Honourable Gentleman, is a very good track record of dealing with Section 12 applications. And in the context of the numbers that have applied, I mean, getting through 304 applications in 1 year, getting through 360 applications in another year, all of these, most of them entirely granted, 134 applications granted in 2014, 158 in 2015, and in 2016, 113. In 2017, 137, and in 2018, 156. I mean, those are large numbers of applications to go through. They each require analysis by our CSRO, Civil Registration Office, Civil Status and Registration Office. They do an excellent job of giving me, as the minister responsible, a summary of each case, a table. You know, in some instances, there was a requirement, for example, to have a knowledge of English. In some other instances where an applicant is over 65, there is no requirement for a knowledge of English. This is a complex area of law, as the Honourable Gentleman will recall from his time in government, indeed from his time in practice, he will know that. And so those that are outstanding, which I expect will be greatly reduced for 19 and 20, once we're able to deal with the backlog, are those on which we are either pending further information, or whether we've deferred, or whether we are, or where we are not getting further information, and they remain as pending. In some instances, indeed, Mr. Speaker, people may have not been in contact with us when we've sought further information because they may have left Gibraltar.
And in relation to that, just again, just on this issue of the pending. So, again, making the point, as I did earlier, I think that I understand issues of backlog in relation to 2020 and 2019, but in the more historic ones, would it be right that those, as they are categorized pending applications, not only the department, but also the person considers it a live application in some way? There's a sort of to-ing and fro-ing of process and so on. So there are still people which the department is interacting with sufficiently so that the department thinks it's a pending application in respect of applications being that have been made 7, 8, 9 years ago. Is that right?
Speaker, at the moment we are in the very happy position that the Honourable Gentleman describes. That is to say that we have, in most years, single-digit still pending applications. In some years, double-digit still pending applications. When I was elected, I found, Mr. Speaker, triple-digit pending applications going back many decades. Many decades, which I thought was, in fact, you know, summarily unfair. The Honourable Gentleman will know, in particular, that you know, these applications sometimes have gone on for many, many years. And I've tried to clear all of these backlogs because I think people deserve the benefit of certainty in respect of these applications. Where the department is still considering live an application, it's because they either still are in contact or seeking contact with an individual. But if we don't get contact back, we leave the application as pending unless we are asked to consider it withdrawn by the applicant. So, I'm going to entirely speculate, but in respect of those pending since 2012, we may have gone back to those individuals to seek further information. They may no longer be here. They may not be getting back to us, and we will not consider the application withdrawn in case they get back to us for some reason, because we would consider it unfair to consider the application withdrawn. We don't consider an application dormant either. Indeed, it may be that we're still in contact with some parties, or if a party has had a reason why we might refuse the application, we might have decided not to refuse the application and keep it pending so that they have the benefit of an application rather than a refusal. But in the context of the backlog that the Honourable Gentleman is referring to, this is the lowest backlog in the history of our community in respect of Section 12 applications. And I confidently expect that by the summer, when I've had an opportunity of going back to the administrative work that I haven't been able to do over the past 12 months, we will see that reduced even further, in particular in respect of the 19 and 20 years, and some of the earlier years which may still be requiring my attention.
And can I ask just finally, generally in respect of all questions, and I appreciate that Chief Minister has answered the question I asked, but he may have this statistic in the supplemental information that the department may have produced for him. Does he have a number on the number of applications that were actually granted in respect of asylum, Section 12, and naturalization? If not, I can submit a supplemental question another day.
Speaker, I'm happy for the Honourable Gentleman to file such a question. What I can tell him from the data I have...
Sorry. I'm pleased for the Honourable Gentleman to file a supplemental... Well, not a supplemental, a question for a future session which provides for that. Because I don't have the data for the years that are in the table. What I can tell him is that for the years 19 and 20... and in September 2020, I'm told, in respect of the previous 5 years, 15 requests for asylum were made and one application was approved. And in the 12 months leading up to September 2020, 53 people of various nationalities were arrested for being on the rock without valid papers and 117 arrested for the offence. The same offence between April 17 and September 20. That's all I have, which gives him, I think, the data he wants for 1 year only. So if he files a question in respect of applications approved, then we'll be able to have that data on the record.
Next question. Question number 842, the Honourable K.S. Abardi.
Mr. Speaker, how many persons died in Gibraltar during the period January 2017 up to and including January 2021 with figures broken down by month?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the information requested is set out in the schedule I now hand over.
Next question. Question 843 has already been answered. We now move to question 844, and the questioner is the Honourable K.S. Abardi.
Mr. Speaker, what payments were made to the former Commissioner of Police on his retirement, specifying the nature of the payments and the amounts?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer together with questions 845 and 846.
Question number 845, the Honourable K.S. Abardi.
Mr. Speaker, Speaker, have the government sold any property to the former Commissioner of Police in the last 6 months, and if so, at what price? Sorry.
Question number 846, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, when will the Chairman, Commissioner of the Public Inquiry into the circumstances surrounding the retirement of the former Commissioner of Police, be appointed?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government can confirm that no payments have been made to the former commissioner other than the sums that may have been due to him as a result of his service. It is not considered a proper use of data controlled by the government for the information on gratuity or pensions of an individual to be disclosed in this House, and it never has been in respect of anyone as far as I'm aware. The same is true in respect of any sale of property to identifiable individuals. The appointment of a chairperson in respect of this inquiry will be announced as soon as the government is able.
Mr. Speaker, on the issue of the property, is the Chief Minister saying that the government isn't just simply not prepared to say? The information that we have is that a property was sold to the former Commissioner of Police, and we wanted to inquire as to the basis of that sale.
Mr. Speaker, it's uncomfortable for the government to be asked any question about any individual and what may have been sold to them, and to have a discussion about that in this House. I can confirm that the property was sold to the former Commissioner of Police whilst he was Commissioner of Police. But disclosing the details of that, I don't think is necessarily fair or appropriate, given that the government holds that information as data controller. I can tell the Honourable Gentleman that the sale involved not just the consideration in cash, but also the release of a government rental property to the government, and the assignment to government of a privately owned property also in exchange for the property in question.
And this transaction happened in accordance with the, if I can describe it, the sitting tenant formula that the government applies in the usual cases?
No, Mr. Speaker. I mean, I don't mind disclosing to the House, because I think it's also not unfair to do so, that this was in the context of the former commissioner considering that he could not continue to live where he was for reasons which were quasi-operational. And the government wanted to assist, of course, as we have in other instances where we've had difficulties involving police officers. And this was a property which the commissioner was not the resident of, but which had come into the possession of the government as a result of a tenant moving out. And the commissioner handed in his tenancy, handed in another tenancy, well, in fact, another private property, which was owned by his partner, and a cash consideration in exchange for that other property. And I'm just reminded by the Honourable the Minister for Financial Services that, of course, this transaction will be on the register because it's a public transaction. The lease will be registered. I'm quite happy to give an indication to the Honourable Gentleman, if he wishes, of what the address is, not across the floor of the House, and they can then search the register and obtain a copy of the lease, if they wish. That, I think, is the best way to ensure that they have the information that they want without entering into exchanges about an individual across the floor of the House.
I'm grateful for that, and perhaps he can do that, and so we can make our own view on that. On the inquiry itself, when he says as soon as possible, I think he said as soon as the government is ready, I'm grateful to Mr. Bolsino on that. I'll just remind him that when he told this House on the 31st of July 2020, so 9 months ago, that the government expected to set up the inquiry quickly. It may take some weeks. That was the position that the government had on the 31st of July. And he said also to the House on the 31st of July. So, Mr. Speaker, the short answer to the issue of timing is that the timing of the convening of the inquiry will not be too long. That will be done as quickly as possible by the government. And if the Chief Minister will recall, the government decided to call an inquiry, to convene an inquiry, because, or for reasons made known by the Chief Minister in his statement to Parliament, but it was against the backdrop where the former Commissioner of Police had issued a statement where he had said as part of his statement that without an independent judicial assessment, there's a real risk to the reputation of Gibraltar as an advanced parliamentary democracy under the rule of law. As a loyal servant of the Crown these past 36 years and a loyal Gibraltarian, Mr. McGrail cannot stand by and watch this potential tarnishing of our city. Does he agree with me that having comments like that been made public, it is important that the convening of the inquiry take place sooner rather than later?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Bosino did the Honourable Leader of the Opposition no favours by inappropriately referring to what I had read out. The words I used were as follows. The appointment of a chairperson in respect of this inquiry will be announced as soon as the government is able, not ready. Mr. Speaker, the government was prepared to convene an inquiry because Mr. McGrail had called for it. Unfortunately, as honourable members know, a lot got in the way of our ability to discharge business in 2020, especially in the latter part of 2020. Towards the end of July, we went into the summer break. There was work being done in order to identify the parameters of the inquiry. Counsel were appointed by the government, and we were in the process of seeking with correspondence with those representing Mr. McGrail to finalise arrangements from the inquiry. Of course, everything has stopped dead after that period. I breathe an air of normality about Gibraltar at the moment, and I've started to go back to holding meetings, which I'm delighted to be able to do, and I very much hope that, therefore, we will be able to resolve this matter as soon as possible, and that's why we're talking about the government appointing a chairperson as soon as we are able.
I mean, obviously, I appreciate all that has transpired in 2020. That's the case. But I'm just reminding the Chief Minister, he said to this House on the 31st of July, it will take a few weeks. Gibraltar went into a second lockdown, in effect a second lockdown at the end of the year, so 6 months on from that. There was a period of significant, at least social normality, although we were living in an unreal world for most of 2020. But insofar as that, can the Chief Minister elaborate a bit more why, given the forecast that he made in July to the House, that it would take a few weeks, why 9 months on we are still in this place? So, for example, when he says he talked, what progress has been made towards that? Can he say to the House, who has been appointed as counsel and solicitors, have they approached, do they have a particular chairman in mind that tentatively has accepted the appointment that he could inform the House about?
Well, Mr. Speaker, if the Honourable Gentleman wants me to tell him what has happened since then, I mean, he'll recall that apart from the pandemic, we were also dealing with the small matter of trying to negotiate Gibraltar's departure from the European Union without a hard Brexit, which continued until the 31st of December, unfortunately, but which the Deputy Chief Minister and the whole of our team were trying to bring to a head and conclude, even before the UK TCA had been announced. So there was a lot of activity consuming the
government in that period. It is true that we were not able to resolve this within a few weeks as we wanted to, which would have been my desired course of action. But there are only a certain number of hours in the day, and of course this issue requires attention so that it can be dealt with entirely properly as is necessary. We have appointed Sir Peter Kahwana and Co. as counsel for the government, and we have already, I understand, had an indication from a judge who is prepared to be appointed, but that will be subject to agreement between all relevant parties. And so, Mr. Speaker, we will seek to resolve this as quickly as possible, and not just for the reasons that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has highlighted, but also because the government wishes to be able to deal with these matters and resolve them as soon as possible.
Well, I appreciate that indication. And does he accept? Look, of course, we were in a fairly abnormal situation, but and of course there are priorities such as Brexit and so on. But does he accept that when allegations or assertions, if assertions are made of a very serious nature, as indeed the former Commissioner of Police made when he issued his public statement calling for an inquiry, these are not helpful and should not stay festering. They need to be inquired by the public inquiry that the government said it would convene. It said that it was eager for those issues to be dealt with, and the sooner these things are established, the better it is. And will the government give the convening of the inquiry a sense of urgency? Because beyond that, of course, once a chairman of the inquiry is appointed, then of course the momentum of the inquiry is out of the government's hands. It's a matter for the chairman of the inquiry, and it takes as long as it takes. But until that happens, the ball is squarely in the government's court on the appointment.
Mr. Speaker, many of the questions that we're dealing with today, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, were filed on or about October. And the business of the administration has really, to a very great extent, unfortunately, ground to a halt. I mean, I both apologize and make no apology for the fact that the government, I think, has rightly concentrated on dealing with the pandemic issues and with the issues that relate to Brexit. Not all of those are obvious. So, in other words, when we're in the throes of the worst moments of a pandemic, all of us know it's happening because we're all stuck at home, we're subject to a lockdown, etc. But there is a lot of action going on behind the scenes so that the government can be ready at that moment to deal with the pandemic in a particular way. On the issue of Brexit, Mr. Speaker, this was also an all-consuming issue which was happening constantly behind the scenes with government in this period. And I think all parties would want to ensure that the government is dealing first with issues that affect the whole community, whilst once again being able to deal with applications, matters that relate to individuals. The question we were dealing with a moment ago about applications under Section 12 is apposite. You know, those are applications that affect individuals. They need to be resolved. You can see from other years that we've resolved with alacrity the applications under Section 12. But in respect of 2019-2020, we have a backlog quite unlike the backlog that we've had in any other year. This is one of the victims. The resolution of this matter, Mr. Speaker, is one of the victims of those issues that consumed the last half of 2020, in particular the last quarter of 2020. And it's almost tautologous to talk about two all-consuming issues, because if something is all-consuming, then there is nothing left for another thing to consume. But in the context of the end of 2020, a government has been faced with two all-consuming issues. The first, the pandemic. The second, the negotiations in relation to Brexit. It's been an extraordinarily difficult year. And this is but one of the victims, the casualties, of us not being able to deal with those issues. But I've already given the House an indication, Mr. Speaker, that the government is seeking to resolve this matter as soon as possible.
Next question. Question number 847, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, what progress is being made to remove the rubble mountain between Eastern Beach and Catlin Bay?
Answer the Honourable... Answer the Honourable Chief Minister.
I will answer with 848.
Question number 848, the Honourable K.S. Aparadi.
Is rubble from construction or other works still being deposited at the rubble mountain between Eastern Beach and Catlin Bay? I mean, obviously, I filed that question before the press release, but...
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the removal of the rubble from the east side is linked to the planned reclamation at Curling Island for the magnificent Victoria Keys development. The environmental impact assessment and the planning application for the reclamation project is currently undergoing the planning process, and once this is completed, it will be possible to begin the removal. The east side rubble tip was closed on the 18th of January 2021, and no further construction rubble is being accepted as from then. That's, the reference the Honourable Gentleman made.
Mr. Speaker, the government is not able to comment about the mechanics of the rubble from construction sites being taken to Spain, other than to say that there are commercial operators in Gibraltar who have obtained licenses in order to be able to undertake that activity. The government in future will deal with its own construction rubble in a particular way. We will have the ability to deal with it. We will want to assist those who have a small-scale rubble arising from non-commercial ventures, for example, somebody who rips out a bathroom. Will have the assistance of the government in order to be able to deal with their rubble without having to fly tip. But commercial operators will have the obligation to deal with rubble themselves, and they will be able to find a number of other operators in the market who will have the necessary permits for the purposes of exporting rubble. And in the medium to long term, we hope to be able to have a rubble processing plant in Gibraltar, which will enable us to then revert to dealing with rubble locally once we have made space. I mean, the Honourable Gentleman knows from his time in government, no doubt, I think at one stage he used to deal with lands, that the most difficult Rubik's Cube in the world is relocations in Gibraltar. And one of the things that we're embarked upon is, in the context of all the many relocations to come, and relocations are always to come, the opportunity to find a space for a rubble recycling plant is one that is high on our agenda.
And can the Chief Minister sort of comment on this? Because obviously we're talking about one of the questions is about the removal of the rubble mountain, and I believe in his original answer he's talking about linking that removal in respect of the Victoria Keys development. But of course, removal means, I assume, in effect, partial removal, because you're still building Hassan Centenary in that area. So it's presumably partial removal of the rubble mountain. What's the kind of time scale of that kind of operation? Has the government received advice on that, bearing in mind the government has a manifesto commitment to have started the removal of the rubble mountain by now, Can he elaborate on that? And also, in relation to his comment on the hope that there will be a rubble processing plant in Gibraltar, is there an identifiable site? And is this a project that the government anticipates will go out to tender?
Mr. Speaker, in relation to one of the earlier questions, I'm told by an avid listener that I confuse my tautologists with my oxymorons in respect of two all-consuming things. It's good to know that we are not speaking just to each other and that people are listening and watching. Mr. Speaker, the timetable for the removal of that part of the rubble mountain that the Honourable Gentleman refers to, and more of it, is hopefully to start during the course of this calendar year. Again, this has been a victim of the halt to which all government projects have succumbed in the past 6 to 12 months, and therefore I very much hope that we'll be seeing progress not just in the removal of that part of the rubble mountain that represents the area where the second phase of Hassan Centenary terraces will go, but also a very large part, if not most of, the rest of what the Honourable Gentleman refers to as the rubble mountain. Part of the referred to rubble mountain is also used to square off the plot and level it off, so it doesn't all go from there. Part of it is used to level off. I'm always reminded, Mr. Speaker, that when honourable members are opposite, they refer to this area as a rubble mountain. And when they hear, they turn to refer to it by more luxurious references, like, for example, Sovereign Bay, etc. I'm sure we all agree that we want to see that which is termed the rubble mountain dealt with as soon as possible and the development of the east side progressed as soon as possible.
I mean, I suppose we can both agree to call it Sovereign Mountain, if he prefers. Can the Chief Minister confirm the kind of cost of removal of the rubble? Is there a sort of cost per ton? Is there like a projected cost for the removal of the rubble over a period of time?
Mr. Speaker, perhaps we should add to the not one grain of sand, not one breath of air, not one drop of our waters, not one sigh of our dust from the rubble mountain in terms of our sovereign mountain. Mr. Speaker, there are different estimates as to the cost of handling this rubble depending on how it is handled and how it is moved. And the use of it for different projects would involve different costs. I don't have those costs available here today.
Next question. Question number 849, the Honourable Keir Sopardi.
Mr. Speaker, does the government know the beneficial owners of all the companies it has entered into contracts with since 2011?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we believe we do.
Next question. Question number 850, the Honourable Keir Sopardi.
Mr. Speaker, are the government aware of an incident on or about the 5th of October 2020 which resulted in a vessel crashing onto the rocks near Waterport after two occupants of the vessel were allegedly fired upon and injured with rubber bullets from a Spanish aduanera vessel?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government are aware of an unacceptable incident that occurred at sea on the 5th of October 2020. And that the matter continues to be investigated by the Royal Gibraltar Police. Briefly, because the matter is sub judice, I can only report on certain facts. On the 5th of October 2020, at shortly before 09:03 hours, the Spanish Guardia Civil RIB, the S2, and not the Spanish Aduanera vessel, commenced a pursuit of a local pleasure craft G2050, being piloted by a local Gibraltarian with another local Gibraltarian also on board. The pursuit commenced in the area of Puente Mayorga in Spanish waters by the beach near the oil refinery. The Royal Navy Gibraltar Squadron on patrol in the bay also observed the pursuit at the time. The pursuit subsequently entered British Gibraltar
territorial waters and continued in an easterly direction towards the western end of the airport runway. Whilst in BGTW, the S2 conducted maneuvers in what appeared to be an attempt to stop G2050 and made contact several times. During one of these contacts, well within BGTW, one of the officers aboard the S2 fired at least two shots using a long-barreled firearm, discharging two non-lethal rubber balls into the vessel. Shortly after, the S2 disengaged from the pursuit in the area off the LNG power plant, and G2050 travelled approximately 200 to 300 metres due east, crashing into the North Mole by the area more or less of where the Jibmarok premises are. As a result of the impact, the occupants were seriously injured in the crash, but have since recovered. Mr. Speaker, can I just say that in the answer I've been given, the Spanish Guardia Civil Group is referred to as S2 or S21. I don't know which of the two is correct. I've referred to S2 throughout, but it may be identified as S21.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that, and without straying into the perhaps investigative dimensions of being conducted by the RGP, or that's a matter for the RGP. Certainly, I pose this question because information had been given to me, and I had been provided with a brief on what had occurred by people who were close to the families, and I had seen I was shown photographs of the injuries of the occupants, and it seemed to me right to table this. This question, does he agree with me, does the Chief Minister agree that the investigative criminal dimensions to one side, which is a matter for the RGP, that these incursions into our waters are unacceptable and that they are doubly unacceptable if those who were steering the Aduanera vessel then took shots with rubber bullets at occupants of an apparently peaceful craft in Gibraltar waters, and does he know whether the British government either directly or at the request of the Gibraltar government have been taking the matter up diplomatically?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I entirely agree with the following caveats only. First, it's not an Aduanera vessel, it's a Guardia Civil vessel, as I told him in the context of my answer. Second, there is absolutely no excuse whatsoever to shoot at a vessel in BGTW, other than in keeping with Gibraltar law, and that would mean if you are a properly empowered Gibraltar law enforcement agency. There is nonetheless a law enforcement reason why it might not be entirely correct to describe this vessel as a vessel that was engaged only in peaceful navigation of our waters, which I don't want to get into because it relates to the substance of the allegations in the context of the Gibraltar investigation, but I would simply add that caveat. Nonetheless, even with that caveat added, I make that caveat in respect of his description, but not in respect of whether or not there should be any shooting with rubber bullets or otherwise, because that is entirely unacceptable, whatever the circumstances. There is a diplomatic process which was engaged as a result of this. The Honourable, the Deputy Chief Minister, and I have dealt with issues like this in the past, also at the United Nations, where we have elevated these issues to the knowledge of the Committee of 24 in New York, when a similar incident occurred in the area of Western Beach, and I referred the C-24 to the fact that we had had, in that context, a jet skier fired upon in our waters in breach of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The Honourable Gentleman knows that there has been no session of the C-24 since the 5th of October 2020, but these matters are matters that we raise routinely there so that we also give them the international dimension that is necessary, because this is an international breach of law also.
Next question. Question number 851. The questioner is the Honourable K. Asoparadi.
Mr. Speaker, how many incursions into Gibraltar territorial waters by vessels of Spanish authorities have there been since the 1st of January 2012, broken down by yearly figures to the end of 2020?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand the Honourable Gentleman a schedule with the information requested.
So can I ask the Chief Minister to comment on the schedule in these respects, if I may? In relation to 2012, across the board, the results are zero. Is it because statistics were not compiled for that year? In respect of the other years, can he perhaps elaborate? I mean, what does LEA stand for? And can he categorize how, when something is categorized as surface incursion and executive action? Perhaps it would help to understand the table he's given me if he explains those.
Mr. Speaker, an LEA is a law enforcement agency compared to a military incursion. An innocent passage, as I understand it, is when there is no change of course and the passage would otherwise be defined as innocent passage under international law. A surface incursion is where that innocent passage has deviated from the rules of an innocent passage, namely by a change of course, for example. And executive action is when a law enforcement agency has acted in a manner that is to seek to act in our waters as if it had jurisdiction in some way. I hope that's helpful.
I see, but I guess that's I suppose that exercise of plotting it is done against the backdrop. If it's innocent passage, because they say it's innocent passage, or it looks to someone keeping the statistic as it's innocent passage. A surface incursion then, if you're on a route of innocent passage, but then you deviate, but you still don't look as if you are taking assertive action. And then I suppose the executive action is more of a sort of assertive catalogue. But who takes those statistics and how do they get catalogued? Is it based on a judgment call of the particular compiler, or is it because or does the fact that certain things get put on one column or the other, is it because there is a particular classification depending on the individual circumstances of the incident and someone has made a judgment call as to that?
Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, these statistics are compiled since we are in office by the Gibraltar Port Authority, who are the ones who make a decision as to innocent passage, etc., by looking at the activity and ensuring that it is in keeping or not in keeping with UNCLOS in any particular respect. I think also the RGP and MOD are involved in the compilation of these statistics using their own data from Windmill Hill and our data from VTS.
I'm grateful for that. I don't think the Chief Minister gave me an answer on why 2012 across the board is zero, but I don't know if he's got that information. Does he agree that we are still seeing a significant number of what have been classified as executive action incursions either by law enforcement authorities or by military vessels in the last few years?
Mr. Speaker, I believe the data was not maintained before we were elected. And that's what I said a moment ago. And we are seeing a disappointingly high number of continued incursions, which of course relates to the respective positions of the government of Gibraltar and the United Kingdom versus the position of Spain in respect of the waters around Gibraltar, where only one position has any substance in international law, and it's the position of the government of the United Kingdom and the government of Gibraltar, because as all honourable members know, UNCLOS is the definitive charter of waters around the world. Gibraltar has been set out to have its territorial waters under UNCLOS since 1982. Spain has entered a reservation in respect of that position, which is well known to the House, but the reservation does not operate as an estoppel against the application of UNCLOS, and therefore the only position recognized in international law is the position of the governments of Gibraltar and of the United Kingdom.
And given that he says that we are still seeing a disappointingly high level of incursions throughout these years, and given that we are in discussions, or we're about to enter into discussions, more meaningful ones, on the possibility of a treaty, that may include a discussion about the monitoring of waters and so on. Is he going to deal with those issues in those talks, or what can be done? What is the government thinking it could do in relation to those disappointing, to use his words, incursions that really should stop?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we have already raised this issue. We will continue to raise this issue in the context of any contact that we have with Spain and with Spanish colleagues. And, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member knows that in the 16 years that they were in government, they had, although there are no statistics, but there is anecdotal evidence that he will recall, many incursions also. And we continue to try and ensure that BGTW is entirely inviolate when it comes to its recognition in international law, because what there is here is an attempt to use these incursions by Spain in order to be able to demonstrate de facto that they have jurisdiction. And that's why, although sometimes fellow Gibraltarians are very frustrated to see another note verbal go in from the British Foreign Office to Spain after these incursions, and only a note verbal, etc., which is a sentiment that all of us have felt, it is hugely important that those note verbals are understood to be essential in the context of preserving the inviolability of Gibraltar's waters under UNCLOS and their continued recognition in international law as only British Gibraltar territorial waters.
Next question.
Question number 852, the Honourable K.S. O'Parity.
Mr. Speaker, what GSLP manifesto commitments are not going to be carried out as a result of the extra spending caused by the COVID pandemic or as a result of the impact of Brexit?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I stated in my New Year's message, in this post-COVID financial world, we will deliver what we can and what we need to from the 2019 GSLP Liberal Manifesto. Our manifesto was written to be delivered despite Brexit, but not despite COVID. As we take policy decisions on which projects we can and cannot undertake, we will make relevant announcements.
Next question.
Question number 853, the Honourable K.S. O'Parity.
Mr. Speaker, will the government be publishing a new subsequent or supplementary part to the Unlock the Rock strategy for the period after September 2020? If so, when? And if not, why not?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer with 854.
Question number 854, the Honourable K.S. Oparadi.
Mr. Speaker, does the government envisage any further BEAT or BEAT type scheme for the period beyond 30th of September 2020? Again, I tabled that question some time ago.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, given the very fluid situation we have confronted during the second wave, the government decided to set out progress in successive statements. We have done so from Convent Place and in this House when appropriate in trying to stick to the system of one statement per week. This has included various announcements on BEAT measures.
Mr. Speaker, the reason for the first question that I asked, which is the subsequent or supplementary part to Unlock the Rock, is because Unlock the Rock strategy that was published in May, I think it was, or April, can't remember, it actually described itself as part one. So it could be one of those Netflix first season and last season wonders, and so I'm asking, was that the season that we followed, or was there going to be a different document? And I think, is it that the Chief Minister is saying that the current thinking, or the thinking that evolved in government since that document was published, is that the situation in COVID is so fluid, I suppose, if I can put it that way, that in fact it's not now the view of government that there would be a published kind of roadmap as it did in May last year. Is that the position? And rather the position is that you would rather stick to a more regular updating of the public on a developing panorama basis. Is that the situation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the best series all end with a cliffhanger. And we have absolutely no intention of being anything other than a blockbuster government. So before we play the Queen's Gambit, and in order to ensure that we don't give up the crown of government, and in order to show honourable members how to get away with delivering a manifesto, I would say to them that what we learnt, Mr. Speaker, from Unlock the Rock is that we never got to the end of part one of Unlock the Rock. Honourable members might know, but in fact they may recall, we've been in touch on these issues. We never unlocked the rock. The final step that was to be taken under part one of Unlock the Rock has not yet come. Because we never moved to a fully unlocked rock before we once again found ourselves having to set new restrictions over the summer. We were very close. I think we were within 48 hours of actually making the statement that was the rock is now unlocked. And I do hope, Mr. Speaker, that we might get to that during the course of this calendar year, if at all possible, full unlocking of the rock. It would be then that part two would be relevant. And, Mr. Speaker, what I think we have learnt in that process is that this was such a quickly developing situation, which came back at us with its second wave, that actually committing to print, which we all thought, I think the Honourable Gentleman was with us in the context of this idea, we all thought was the right approach, and we worked together on, including the paragraph on Lionwell Road, I would gently once again remind him, I think we have decided that it is not in anyone's interest that we seek to set out in a document how we will once again deal with the issues of unlocking. And what we need to do is deal with the issues now of recasting how we go forward. And that, I think, will likely be done in the context of government statements, indeed in the budget, etc., as the whole process develops. Two things have really become so intimately entwined: the Brexit and post-Brexit world and the negotiations, and the COVID and post-COVID world and the removal of restrictions. And all of those create a cocktail for the future that we still have to determine the exact ingredients of.
Mr. Speaker, much as we all enjoy thrillers and cliffhangers, I don't think as a community, we probably want a cliffhanger in this particular season of the pandemic. I certainly don't want to discover Bobby Ewing waking up in the shower after he had been killed in relation to COVID. I'm showing my age with that analogy, which I'm sure is lost on the Netflix generation. Mr. Speaker, I actually expected a slightly different answer. I expected the answer, not that we haven't got to the unlock, because the unlock the rocks strategy, actually, the timescale and roadmap all led us with very structured timescales to the 1st of August 2020 and beyond when, yes, for reasons that have been well ventilated, the government decided to keep certain measures in place. But I thought actually the thinking had evolved into a position of a more dynamic, less straitjacketed, perhaps, if you could take that view. Not that I think that the Unlock the Rock document was a straitjacket, because it was a pretty dynamic document, but I thought that the approach had evolved to so that the government were going to rule out a more published roadmap. But I hear what the Chief Minister is saying. Can I ask him on the BEAT measures? The reason I left this question on the order paper is, yes, the government has made its views known on the BEAT schemes beyond the 30th of September. The feedback I am getting from those in certain sectors, in particular the restaurant and catering sector, is that those sectors are seeing a pretty sort of mixed reaction. There are good days and bad days. The investor, the sort of consumer confidence is not consistent, fairly volatile. There are some places that are full one day, not on others, and that they are feeling the restrictions that continue in place. So can I urge the government to consider, as soon as possible, lifting the restrictions, or at least softening the current restrictions that remain in place in respect of the catering industry, in particular in terms of one of the things that was unclear when the government, for example, announced the lifting of the curfew, and perhaps the Chief Minister could clarify. One of the things that I've been asked post the announcement on the curfew is, does that mean then that it affects closing times on restaurants and so on as well? There is a lack of clarity, and I would be grateful if he would clarify that.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I don't think it's the government trying to create a cliffhanger that we found ourselves at the end of Unlock the Rock, not being able to unlock the rock. It was the inevitable consequence of the return of infections, indeed not just in Gibraltar but also around us, because the government has to have an eye to what's happening not just in Gibraltar but what's happening around us, especially in the context of the period when we didn't have vaccinations and infections were going up around us. So the Honourable Gentleman will forgive me for disagreeing with him also in the context of Bobby Ewing. I mean, nothing could make me happier than to wake up sometime in February 2020 to find that everything that we have lived since then is no more than a nightmare. This is called dream sequencing in screenplaying. And I really do wish, Mr. Speaker, that I were dreaming and I had not lived this, and that all of us could wake up once again in February 2020 without having to go through what we've gone through and the loss of life. But, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman puts to me, as what he thought my position would be, exactly what I explained to him was my position, but described in a different way. So I've said we're going to be
more dynamic by dealing with the issues in government statements going forward, rather than creating a document that might be stale, so to speak, as soon as it is published. That's what we learnt in the first wave. Unlock the Rock document still, Mr. Speaker, gives us, in my view, a lot of detail, which has been very helpful as we have been unlocking restrictions this time. So we've referred back to sporting associations being able to go back to activity as they did under the Unlock the Rock document, etc. So it's a valuable document, but it's not a document that's apposite now. So, Mr. Speaker, I really do think that the way that we are approaching it now has the benefit of the lessons that we learnt as a result of the initial lockdown having come to an end. Mr. Speaker, in respect of the restaurant and catering sector, well, there are very few restrictions still in place. There is the requirement that waiters and other members of staff are double masked. That is a requirement that will continue until we're satisfied that all those who are working in catering establishments are properly inoculated. But the only other restriction, I think, which is apposite, is the one relating to last orders. There are none of the other restrictions in place anymore. Mr. Speaker, I've already been in touch with the chairman or president of the Gibraltar Catering Association this morning and clarified that those restrictions will be removed with the curfew. And indeed, I've also clarified that those are not restrictions in regulations, they're just in the permits granted for operation. It is also true, Mr. Speaker, as I understand it, that there are some sectors of our community that are going to be more affected going forward than others, depending on whether or not we see the return of tourism during this calendar year. And I would say that probably the catering sector is one of the sectors that's going to be affected, but not as affected as other sectors. I mean, one of the areas that I know will be particularly affected is the tourism transport trade. The Honourable the Minister for Transport and I have had a very positive meeting today with the Gibraltar Taxi Association, who I must say have been incredibly helpful to the government in the rollout of our vaccination strategy. They've assisted us greatly in conveying people to the vaccination centre where they have not been able to convey themselves there. They really, really worked with us, and this is a sector that's been in receipt of BEAT payments for longer than most, but because their business is just not arriving in Gibraltar, we work very closely with them to ensure the protection of the livelihoods of those who are working in the taxi trade and including those who work in the taxi's offices. And we will look at other sectors that require that level of assistance also to ensure that we can continue to provide help. In the catering sector, many will be relatively back to normal absent their tourist trade. Many did not rely on the tourist trade and will be back to their very successful local trade. So we now move to perhaps a less industry significant understanding of the issues, because in one industry you can have one player doing very well indeed because he's got his business back and another player who has not got his business back. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, one of the things that's relevant now is that Gibraltar is closer to being unlocked than we have been for some time, but the areas around us are not so open, and so many people are choosing to stay in Gibraltar and therefore avail themselves of the fact that Gibraltar is relatively open, hopefully will be even more open soon, and indeed that in Gibraltar it is easier to sit at the table in a catering establishment and do other things outside of the town centre. So I think this will now be a more sophisticated analysis of what we need to continue doing in terms of assistance, and Mr. Speaker, I think with respect to the House, I think the government in some parts also by agreement with the opposition have done an important job in supporting those sectors of our economy that could not continue operating during the pandemic in a way that has cost the public purse greatly, but this was the right way to spend public money at this time in order to keep operators in our economy alive and ready to continue activity as soon as we were able to resume where we'd left off.
Next question.
Question number 855, the Honourable K.S. Aparadi.
Mr. Speaker, can government update the House as to when the quarantine-free air corridor with the UK will be restored?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we'll answer with 856.
Question number 856, the Honourable K.S. Obadi.
Is government in discussions with the UK so as to ensure that Gibraltar residents who have been vaccinated for COVID-19 are exempt from the UK quarantine rules?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as all honourable members will know, the United Kingdom suspended its travel corridors with effect from the 18th of January. The United Kingdom government's roadmap for easing lockdown restrictions in England was announced on the 22nd of February. In respect to international travel, the United Kingdom government has stated that the Global Travel Task Force will report on the 12th of April with recommendations aimed at facilitating a return to international travel as soon as possible, while maintaining the risk from imported cases and variants of concern. Following that, the United Kingdom will determine when international travel should resume, which will be no earlier than the 17th of May. The United Kingdom government has as yet not published any plans for travellers who have been vaccinated from COVID-19 to be exempt from the UK quarantine rules. Indeed, even travellers who have received the vaccination are still required to provide evidence of negative tests and be tested on arrival at the airport. However, the United Kingdom government's roadmap out of lockdown has indicated that vaccinations could offer a route to that safe and sustainable return. It has stated that once more is known about the evidence of vaccines on transmission and their efficacy against new variants, the government can look to introduce a system to allow vaccinated individuals to travel more freely internationally. We will continue to be in touch with the United Kingdom Department for Transport through the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office and the Convent in Gibraltar.
Given that the UK most recently, I think in the House of Commons has commented about the vaccination program in Gibraltar in glowing terms through the mouth, I think, of the Secretary of State for Health. Is the government impressing upon the UK? And obviously, I understand the structural roadmap that the Chief Minister has given, and that indeed the UK has indicated that international travel may not start till the 17th of May. But has the Chief Minister and the government impressed upon the UK the hopefully the correlation between the success of the vaccination program and the restrictions or the facilitation that could be made to travellers from Gibraltar, given the trend of cases in Gibraltar, which presumably in large measure has been also driven not simply by the lockdown but also by the vaccination program?
Mr. Speaker, the government, I think, is able to point to a huge success in the context of our relationship with the United Kingdom government in this respect. Our travel corridor was not suspended with the United Kingdom when it was operative, even at times when our figures were worryingly high when calculated over the 100,000. Because the United Kingdom, in particular the Foreign Commonwealth Development Office and the Department for Transport, understood that the travel corridor with Gibraltar is not just about tourism. Indeed, it's not just about business. It's about the umbilical link between Gibraltar and the United Kingdom. I think the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, must, in setting his question, no doubt reflect upon that incredible success, because when we were subject to weekly analysis by the United Kingdom, and when our numbers were higher than the numbers of other European countries, the reality of Gibraltar, namely that there were not 100,000 people here, and therefore the extrapolation over that figure was an unrealistic one, also the fact that the corridor is not just for tourism or business, but it's about that umbilical link, and there are other human reasons for movement between Gibraltar and the United Kingdom, which cannot be established in any other way. And the work that we were doing with Public Health England
very closely working with Public Health Gibraltar, the Gibraltar Health Authority working closely with the Department of Health and Social Care in the United Kingdom, all of those things and the transparency that they had from Gibraltar, all of those things enabled us to maintain the air travel corridor between Gibraltar and the United Kingdom when others might have expected it to go down. And I think that's a demonstration of the depth of the relationship and of the support that Gibraltar has had from the United Kingdom in this period. When all of the travel corridors went down, only then did ours go down. So in the context of looking forward, Mr. Speaker, we are in constant touch through the SCDO and through the convent with relevant Whitehall departments. We have very good arguments to make, not just those which the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, has put. Gibraltar has in effect been part of the UK's vaccination programme. Just today, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition may have noted the news is about the extension of the travel ban in the United Kingdom into July. That's part of the news. The opening headline of today's Times is overseas travel ban extended until July. So this is an issue which is still very much at large. It's about not importing variants of concern from the continent to the United Kingdom. Gibraltar expects that we will not be seen just as part of the continent of Europe because with a fully vaccinated population and a fully vaccinated imported working population, there should be no variants of concern in Gibraltar. There is the possibility of restricting travel to the United Kingdom from Gibraltar to those who are residents of Gibraltar and to those who are vaccinated. All of those options are on the table in order to give the United Kingdom the confidence that Gibraltar is a place through which a travel corridor in the nature of that umbilical connection can safely be established. And there are already, the Honourable the Minister for Transport has done a lot of work to ensure that there are already continued flights between Gibraltar and the United Kingdom. And we hope that the extensive schedule of flights, more extensive than has ever been the case, to a network of airports like there has never been before, can be re-established as soon as possible. And then, Mr. Speaker, the magnificent work of Samantha Sacramento as Minister for Health and the excellent work of Vijay Dadianani as Minister for Transport will really come into its own.
Next question.
Question number 857, the Honourable Kenya Sapare.
Mr. Speaker, have the government commissioned any study or expert report in relation to questions concerning the impact or feasibility of joining the customs union as part of a future relationship with the EU?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer with 858 to 864.
Question number 858, the Honourable K.S. Oparadi.
Mr. Speaker, just tell the clerk that I'm going to withdraw 860, which has been dealt with publicly since I tabled the question. 858, was it? Mr. Speaker, how will hot pursuit situations be dealt with in a possible Schengen association stemming from the New Year's Eve agreement on a future relationship with the EU?
Question number 859, the Honourable K.S. Sapardi.
When and how will the government be consulting about any possible customs union type arrangement or bespoke goods arrangements with the European Union as part of any agreement on Gibraltar's future relationship with the EU?
Question 860 has now been withdrawn. We go to question 861, the Honourable K.S. Oparadi.
Have there been any formal or informal talks between the EU, and the UK, or the UK, Spain and Gibraltar in relation to progressing the discussions towards a possible treaty for a future relationship with the EU in respect of Gibraltar since the 1st of January 2021, and if so, will the government update the House in relation to such talks?
Question number 862, the Honourable K.S. Oparadi.
Is the government aware of the state of discussions to establish the EU negotiating mandate in respect of the negotiations with the UK concerning the possible treaty for a future relationship with the EU in respect of Gibraltar?
sorry.
Question number 863, the Honourable K.S. Obari.
Is it still expected that the talks to conclude a treaty setting out a future relationship for Gibraltar with the EU will require till the end of June 2021, or does government expect the process to require time beyond that?
Question number 863, the Honourable K.S. Obari.
In the event that talks to conclude a treaty on a future relationship with the EU in respect of Gibraltar require to be extended beyond the end of June 2021, what plans are being discussed or agreed to enable the current regime of extended or temporary recognition by Spain of Gibraltar-issued documents, driving licenses or pet passports, or current regime for movement across the border to continue pending the conclusion of such talks?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I invited the Honourable Gentleman to review his questions and see whether he was going to withdraw any some days ago. I mean, for him to withdraw it now is really unhelpful in the sense that I've already got a prepared answer in respect of that question. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, the in-principle agreement reached on the 31st December 2020 has already been made public by a leak in a Spanish newspaper. The government is taking professional advice on all aspects of the proposed EU-UK treaty, including the aspects that relate to trade in goods. The government is already talking to interested parties in our economy and has set up a committee which will start considering information and proposals the government will be relying on in the forthcoming negotiation. This committee, the Treaty Liaison Advisory Committee, will meet this week for the first time. The government will not be making any statements on any particular negotiating position in respect of the proposed UK-EU treaty at this stage, other than to say that the position of Gibraltar is clear as to what is or is not acceptable. We will not accept any incursion on our sovereignty, jurisdiction or control. We will not waver from that position. I'm happy to report to the House that this is also the position unwaveringly of Her Majesty's Government of the United Kingdom, and in particular of the Foreign Secretary, the Right Honourable Dominic Raab, and the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Boris Johnson. Since the 1st of January 2021, the EU, Spain, the UK and Gibraltar respectively have been working towards settling the separate negotiating mandates of each for the future proposed treaty between the EU and the UK in relation to Gibraltar. Certainly as far as the UK and Gibraltar are concerned, I can assure the Honourable Member that a lot of work has been done in developing the GIB-UK negotiating mandate with the full involvement and participation of my office as the lead negotiator for Gibraltar and the Office of the United Kingdom Foreign Secretary. The negotiations for a future treaty between the EU and the UK in relation to Gibraltar have unfortunately still not started. It is therefore impossible to say at this stage whether the treaty will be concluded by the end of June. That remains the target date for the conclusion of the treaty, but clearly much will depend on how the negotiations progress once they start. The June date should not be seen as being hardwired into the process, but it remains the aspiration of Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar to conclude this treaty as soon as possible. The government has successfully negotiated a number of bridging measures. The bridging measures are under constant review, and there is an understanding that they will be extended until such time as the future treaty between the EU and the UK in relation to Gibraltar enters into force. The same is true of the MOUs under the withdrawal agreement, which are in the process of being extended.
Mr. Speaker, I mean, the Chief Minister has rolled up a few questions, so I've got a number of supplementaries, if I may. In relation to the customs union, he says he's taking professional advice on that. From what kind of profession? Can you give us an indication in respect of that? And when was the engagement of those particular professionals undertaken? Is this a sort of historic engagement of professional advice because in the run-up to a post-Brexit they thought they wanted advice, or is this a more recent engagement on a more focused exercise?
Mr. Speaker, the government has contracted, apart from the extensive professionals that it employs that provide excellent advice in respect of all aspects of this treaty, but we've contracted with external entities to provide advice. One of them is Sir Jonathan Fall, who is a former senior commission official.
Another is a gentleman by the name of Michel Petit from Clifford Chance in London, a former head of the Commission Legal Service. And the government has also engaged Messrs. Ernst & Young.
Is this Ernst & Young locally, or sort of the London, the London base of Ernst & Young? Can I ask him on that? And is Ernst & Young specifically advising on the conducting of feasibilities in relation to joining the customs union, the different permutations? And if so, can he give us an outline of the kind of work they would be doing? Because it's I imagine, a fairly constrained period of time before which a judgment needs to be made by those negotiating the treaty in respect of the customs union parts.
Mr. Speaker, the engagement involves Ernst & Young London and Ernst & Young Gibraltar, and is a wide engagement and includes elements which relate to the customs union. Other advice is also being obtained in respect of the customs union involving other professionals inside the government service, in particular the expertise that we have available from our own customs department. The consultation with TLAC will also be particularly relevant. And, Mr. Speaker, I think that the government is very well placed to do the analysis it needs to do in the context of the decisions that we will need to make as a result of this negotiation.
I mean, in respect of the customs union itself, does the Chief Minister agree with me that obviously, we've been outside the customs union for many, many years, and it's not suggested, of course, that there is an inevitability of our customs union, because the Chief Minister has explained on previous occasions that there are different permutations, and one of them is a sort of bespoke customs union arrangement. But even to do that, to sort of define the suit, if the measuring up of the suit process, there would need to be an engagement, a sort of wide engagement and understanding of the Gibraltar economy, the projections and the feasibilities, the business case for it. Shouldn't there be an engagement with the business community well beyond simply this committee that the government has set up? And how is the government, if it considers it's going to engage more widely with the business community, how is it going to do that? And how will the experts that the government have commissioned, how are they going to make a judgment on feasibility of options without the most wide engagement with the business community on all these issues?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the honourable member, by looking at the composition of TLAC, will see that actually it encompasses the representation of just about every economic actor in our community. So the government is satisfied that through TLAC we actually have a reach through into all of our business community. But at the same time, the government is engaging directly with industry leaders to ensure that the information that we have, both through TLAC and through the government's own data, is accurate, and that we've interpreted it accurately. We have taken the heat maps that we took at the time of the referendum, which gave us a lot of data, which enabled us to make decisions about what it is that are relevant aspects of our economic activity going forward that we need to protect, and what are the opportunities for economy that we need to look out for. And so in the engagement that we will have with those that represent all of the sectors of our community, and with the engagement that we will have with those who are industry leaders in their particular sectors, I think that we will have all of the information that we need to make the right decisions for Gibraltar. And that, Mr. Speaker, is a process that has already begun and that will become even more apparent as we are freed from the difficulties that we had during the COVID pandemic to be able to engage more directly also with the parties that I'm describing.
Can the Chief Minister confirm whether, in the context of the work by these experts, Ernst & Young in particular, are they sort of conducting simulations of economic models going forward in relation to different permutations of the customs union, what kind of customs union, bespoke arrangement or not? Are they collating or conducting surveys that would assist with that work? Are they doing that kind of work also? And will that work fan out into the community?
No, Mr. Speaker, the work that has been done by Ernst & Young is more strategic in its nature. A lot of the work that the Honourable Gentleman is describing, we would be doing in the context of the work that our Customs Department is able to do. And indeed, we don't very often nowadays need questionnaires. We actually have a lot of data available to us through the ASICUDA system and through the expertise of those who already serve the government. So what we don't want to do is to waste the time of economic operators in Gibraltar by asking them to fill in questionnaires unless that becomes essential. We have a good see-through to the imports into the Gibraltar economy, and we have a good understanding of the market, but we want to test that to ensure that we're not missing anything, and that's why we're going to be talking to the representative groups and to the individual industry leaders to ensure that we have properly interpreted the data that we have, and we'll seek further data from them if we need to.
So, am I right in understanding the role of Ernst & Young is strategic in the sense that the Chief Minister says, we think we've got the data, and we then funnel it up to Ernst & Young. He hasn't put it that way, of course, but they will then crunch the numbers against a backdrop of strategic options. We will then engage with those experts and decide a way forward, also in consultation with the industry leaders and the committee. Is that the role of the engagement of Ernst & Young? Have I understood it properly?
No, Mr. Speaker, it's not. The role of Ernst & Young, as I described it, is much more strategic than that.
Mr. Speaker, I'll give him another opportunity because I'm failing to understand it. I thought it was strategic in the way that I had described it. In other words, they get data, but perhaps he can elaborate as to the strategy. And can he answer just on the customs union point before I move on to other questions that I had? Is there an intention for the government to put out a consultation paper as to, once it reaches a conclusion, as to the kind of bespoke customs arrangement it envisages, so that the community is more widely informed and there can be feedback?
Mr. Speaker, the work that is being done by Ernst & Young, as I've already said, is strategic. In other words, it is about the development of Gibraltar and the region around it, and how the opportunities that we expect we will see arise from the treaty might assist us all to create an area of shared prosperity, and indeed some of the areas that we might not appreciate that the treaty could open up if we're able to conclude it. What the Honourable Gentleman is describing is a tactical advice for the purposes of dealing just with one aspect of what the treaty might provide for. That, Mr. Speaker, we are entirely satisfied will be something that we're able to do by taking the advice of the representative organizations, as we're going to do in the context of the work of TILAC, by then talking to the industry leaders without the need to do the questionnaires or consultation paper that the Honourable Gentleman has proposed, because we don't think that that is an efficient way of managing this process. We think that's quite a, in fact, I mean this in no disrespectful way, but I think that's quite a pedestrian way to see how we might progress through this period. We think actually we are being much more proactive by doing the work that we're doing, analysing the data that we have, knowing the market as we know it, and consulting on the potential for the market to develop, and therefore making decisions about how we might approach the final text of the treaty, ensuring that we don't in any way shut off any potential strategic advantage for Gibraltar going forward that we might not otherwise be cognizant of, and in a way that delivers this potential for the whole area to work together to create a larger economic benefit for all.
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to move on, but can I also ask whether, in relation to that, and apart from the engagement of Ernst & Young, have there been any more historic studies or expert reports in relation to the impact or feasibility of joining the customs union? I'm not sure if the Chief Minister answered that, but I'll give him an opportunity to perhaps answer it again or fill in that that information if he didn't provide it. More historic than Ernst & Young, but post-Brexit, obviously, because I'm not talking about much more historic than that. But has the government conducted or engaged with experts in relation to this field before the engagement with Ernst & Young on these issues?
Mr. Speaker, I think I have told him that our heat maps set out a lot of data about how our market operates, and that includes how our market in goods operates. And the electronic system that we have in place, ASICUDA, which deals with the importation of goods into Gibraltar, is now something that we can interrogate very quickly to see what is being imported and at what price it is being imported. And we can see at what price those goods are going in the market. And therefore, we have a very good see-through of what is happening in our economy in goods. And therefore, by correlating that to the work that we're going to do with the representative bodies in TLAC and with the industry leaders who we'll be talking to specifically, we are satisfied that we will have the most up-to-date and most relevant data available in making the decisions that we will have to make in the context of the negotiation of the treaty.
So moving on to other questions, if I may. The Chief Minister talks about this work towards settling the mandate. I assume the mandate, the negotiating mandate, at least of the EU, needs to be approved by the European Council of Ministers. Does he have visibility or information that he could share across the floor of the House in respect of the progress of the mandate? And he said talks had not started yet, but does he have visibility of the kind of timescale for the start of the talks at a more serious level?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is asking me about what is the state of play on the what we might call the other side of the negotiating table. And I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment in that respect because we have not yet engaged with the EU with us having a mandate ready to go and them having a mandate ready to go. And therefore, it would be unfair and almost disrespectful to seek to impute to the European Commission any timetable which they have not yet officially shared.
Mr. Speaker, I was not asking him that question. I had understood, and maybe I may have misunderstood his response, but I had understood when he used a phrase that they were working towards settling the mandate. I thought that this was a sort of free flow exchange of discussions between the EU, UK, Spain, Gibraltar as to where the respective sides were in settling their own mandates without obviously sharing confidences on the EU side of what they're talking about. So I thought that he would be in a position to indicate when the talks would commence. Is he in a position to do that? Or he's spoken about not being able to talk about the opposite side's mandate, but is he in a position to indicate when he thinks talks will start?
Mr. Speaker, if I had a date on which I knew talks would start, I would have already informed the public in Gibraltar.
Mr. Speaker, given that we are practically, well, it's Easter next week and we're coming into April, I hear what the Chief Minister has said about the expectation on whether it's possible to conclude an agreement by a treaty by the end of June, and he said that there was an understanding that the bridging measures would be extended, I think in the context of the run-up to an implementation of a treaty, but am I right in understanding what he said as being, and that as long as in principle there is progress and the parties are about to enter into a treaty, there will be an extension. But what happens if actually we're not at that stage? Is the understanding on the extension that while talks are proceeding, the bridging measures will be extended, which is a position that will give people more comfort? Or is it the position that the bridging measures, the understanding on the bridging measures is that they will only be extended if, in principle, a treaty has been tentatively agreed?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the position is as I informed the whole of the community on the national broadcaster during Direct Democracy last week on the 16th of March, when I said that whilst we believed that there was going to be a treaty, we might not be able to achieve it by June. We were giving ourselves until the end of the year in the context of extension of bridging measures and MOUs. And look, if we get to the end of the year, Mr. Speaker, and we haven't yet got a treaty, but we feel, or both sides or all sides feel, that it's likely that there is shortly to be one, then I'm sure there would be an extension. But we would all hope to have been able to resolve matters before the end of the year. And I would still try to see whether it's possible to resolve matters before the summer. I mean, the important thing is that we have the right treaty, Mr. Speaker, because as Gibraltar knows, this government certainly won't sign up to a treaty that is not the right treaty for Gibraltar. We would rather no treaty than a bad treaty, but we will work for a good treaty, and we will continue to be optimistic that we will be able to achieve a good treaty, just as we were optimistic that we would be able to achieve in principle political agreement, and we did.
Next question. Question number 865, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Mr. Speaker, does the government have any existing contracts or contractual arrangements with Bland Limited or paid that company for any services? And if so, when, for what service or work, and how much has been paid in the last 12 months?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer with 865 to 868.
Question number 866, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Have the government entered into or terminated any contracts or contractual arrangements with Bland Limited or paid that company for any services? And if so, when, for what service or work, and how much has been paid over the last 12 months?
Question number 867, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
When was the agreement or contractual commitments or arrangements between the government and Bland Limited in respect of services concerning the maintenance of the National Security Central Intelligence System entered into, and what monthly or annual remuneration or fees or other payments have been made by the government under it since then?
Question number 868, the Honourable K.S. Opardi.
Have the government entered into any contracts or contractual arrangements with 36 North Limited or paid that company for any services? And if so, when, for what service or work, and how much has been paid?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government has a number of different arrangements with the Bland Group, which trades under different names, Bland Limited and OSG. The services provided by the Bland Group are quite extensive, from the provision of security at No. 6 Common Place and various sites, to the offering of IT deliverables such as programs to handle the Employment Department databases, to the offering of the NCIS system to help protect our borders, to airport handling services, and to the provision of travel arrangements, including the use of the Roc Hotel and the storage of documents, non-issued notes and coins. The total sum paid to Bland OSG in the past 12 months to date has been £6,942,516.07. The total amount paid to Bland in the previous 12 months was, and in each year since 2011, has been as follows, and totals in excess of £55 million. In the financial year 2011-2012, 1,384,555.54. In the financial year 2012-2013, £4,304,262.96. In the financial year 2013-2014, £4,958,639.15. In the financial year 2014-2015, £5,373,383.27. In the financial year 2015-2016, £5,962,879.21. In the financial year 2016-2017, £6,319,688.49.
In the financial year 2017-2018, £6,728,894.48. In the financial year 2018-2019, £6,747,600.87. In the financial year 2019-2020, £6,442,404.89, and in the financial year 2020-2021 to date, £6,942,516.07. That makes a total, Mr. Speaker, of £55,164,823. Mr. Speaker, the figures above show a gradual increase in the amount paid to the Bland Group over the years. That our ad hoc agreements entered into on an ongoing basis, so for example, in terms of security, we're constantly taking decisions to ask the Bland Group to relocate staff at different locations. An example of this was during COVID when it was deemed necessary to increase security at some government frontline services. Clearly, when we have asked them to write software, for example, in the context of the employment department, there has been a specification, etc., in place. These things usually follow a tender process which sets out the specification of what government is looking for. That said, Mr. Speaker, there is no agreement that I know of that has been terminated in the last 12 or 24 months. The only major contract that has reached an end of term is the Air Terminal Handling Services Agreement, which was entered into by the former GSD government and which expired on the 28th of November 2018. Despite this contract having reached its termination, both parties have agreed to continue with the arrangement that is in place until such time as the government is able to focus on how it sees the airport developing. Mr. Speaker, it is difficult to analyse the types of services provided, given everything is invoiced in the name of Bland Group. However, by focusing on the departments, I can broadly confirm to Parliament that the following services were provided in the last two financial years. The Service of Information Technology in the year 2019-20 produced a payment of £59,648.84, and in the year 2021, £110,341.45. In the context of travel, £1,824.50 was paid in 2019-20, and £1,776 was paid in 2020-2021. In the context of security, £2,985,287.62 was paid in 2019-2020, and £2,792,018.97 was paid in 2020-2021. The NCIS contract attracted a payment of £500,710 in 2019-2020 and £975,599.25 in 2020-21. There was no payment for the hire of buses in the financial year 19-20, but there was a payment of £86,570 in the financial year 20-2021. Mr. Speaker, in the context of airport handling services, £2,894,933.93 was paid in 1920 and £2,976,210.40 was paid in 2020-2021. In terms of the totals, Mr. Speaker, that represents the totals that I've given the House before in respect of 1920 of £6,442,404.89 and in respect of 2021 of £6,942,516.07. As regards the NCIS system, this originally started out as a contract designed at the bespoke request of the government to monitor border fluidity that has evolved into something that is a lot more sophisticated. This agreement dates back to January 2015, but in those days it was just to enable us to monitor the length of the border queue and accurately report this to the EU. Since then, it was decided, in combination with OSG, to turn this into a mechanism to protect our borders and monitor activity. This contract now covers a lot of security-related matters, such as the scanning of passports at entry points to the ANPR logging of number plates of vehicles crossing the border. It is a very wide agreement, and given its sensitivity of some of the functions carried out for government in the security space, I would rather not disclose all aspects of the arrangement publicly.
I'm happy, Mr. Speaker, to have a detailed discussion with the Honourable Gentleman to tell him everything that the system does. We're presently being charged £67,644.75 per month for this arrangement. This amount has varied over the years as the services have increased. Mr. Speaker, the discrepancy between the figures for NCIS between 2019-20 and 2020-21 is on account of an issue relating to an outage of service dating back to September 2018. Since that date, the government has paid a reduced amount of £50,000 against their monthly invoices of £66,693.75. A settlement was recently reached with Blands covering the period for a total of £338,979. Mr. Speaker, in respect to 36 North, I preface my answer by saying that as my declaration of interest shows, I am a partner on sabbatical of Hassan's. The partners of Hassan's have a 33.33% interest in 36 North through a holding company called Astalon Limited. The sums paid to that company in the last two financial years is as follows. In the financial year 18-19, a sum of £22,340.61, and in the joint financial year of 2019-20, which is a two-year period, £79,647.84. The 2018-19 figures were in the main made up of a number of services provided to the Environment Department, including security for their new premises at Leon's Place at £1,261.66, and a consultancy on a cable to Morocco in respect of renewable energy at £1,500 per month for 7 months, together with other small services provided. In addition, there was a card reader deployed to the Borders and Coast Guard Agency for £1,997.02. The 2019-21 figures include the consultancy to the environment, which continued for a further 18 months. In addition, the Education Department purchased two thermal imagers and tripods for a total of £28,222. The Upper Rock and Beaches Department also purchased a further thermal temperature sensor for £9,933.18. The rest is made up of small individual purchases by the Environment Department, totaling some £14,000. None of these contracts have been approved or cleared by me. They are within the limits of what heads of departments are able to agree without regard to my ministry.
Mr. Speaker, can I just ask, in terms of the difference in the figures in the National Security Intelligence system, and without treading into the areas that the Chief Minister has said, that I'm happy to have a discussion with him behind the Speaker's chair, but on the, I'm not sure if I followed the explanation of the difference between the 500,000 loosely and the 975,000. He said it was an issue with the outage of the service. So, but why was it then that there was a much higher figure the subsequent year? Or is he saying that there was a lower figure the previous year because of the outage of the service? I didn't quite understand the explanation.
Mr. Speaker, what I said was that the discrepancy arose from that outage of service, because since the outage, the government had paid a reduced amount. We had paid £50,000 a month in respect, instead of the whole amount, by agreement, whilst the whole thing was settled, instead of £66,693,000. And then a settlement was reached covering the total period since that outage, and the payment in respect of that settlement was for £338,979. So all of that would have been weighted in the year in which that settlement was paid.
And in relation to the Bland's contracts themselves, and he's given us the figure of about 55.1 million over the last few years, since 2011-12, he said, and the current contract for contracts in relation to Bland OSG Group, I think he said, is now around 6.9 million this year to date. Previous years in the last 4 or 5 years have been in excess of 6 million. Can he indicate to us which of those services have been put out to tender?
Not without notice, Mr. Speaker, because there's many contracts, so I would need to be able to show him exactly where there have been tenders or where there have been continuations of contracts which have simply increased in volume.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful. I had understood, because he made in part of his answer, he spoke about some of the contracts that had been put out to tender, so I thought he had that information. But I will table another question at another time for that and ask him for that information. In respect of the National Security Intelligence System, and again, I'm not dealing with the issues, more sensitive issues that he said, but I understand that as he said, it was originally designed for a particular purpose, but then it's moved on into a more sort of dynamic organism for other purposes. We did ask in other questions that I tabled in the House which were answered by the Deputy Chief Minister some time ago, in October actually, he told me that there were problems with the sort of counting system in the ANPR CCTV system, because he said at the time, and I'm just quoting so that the honourable member to facilitate his answer, he said when he gave me certain statistics on the numbers of vehicles crossing into Spain and into Gibraltar, he said, the honourable member should note that these figures are collected automatically through the ANPR CCTV system, and I'm told that they are supplied with the proviso that they are less accurate than the manually taken entry figures. Is this ANPR vehicle sort of numbers collation system, is that part of the work being done under this system?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I specifically, I think, referred to the ANPR aspect in the context of my first answer. In fact, I said the contract now covers a lot of security-related matters, such as the scanning of passport and entry points to ANPR logging of number plates of vehicles crossing the border. I think in the context of the answer that the Deputy Chief Minister gave the Honourable Gentleman, it was about the exit area where counters had also been provided and there had been a change of how vehicles exited and how individuals exited, and therefore there had not been an alignment, a realignment of cameras, and for a period we had lost the exact count that we had had earlier. But this is provided by the same system.
I'm grateful. Mr. Speaker, and in relation to 36 North, he's declared the issue that the equity partners of Hassan's are 33% owners of one of the shareholders of 36 North. And he ended his answer saying that none of the contracts were cleared or approved by me. Was he aware that the government was going to contract with 36 North before the contractual arrangements were entered into?
The answer to that question, Mr. Speaker, is no. I have been made aware of these contracts in providing the answer to the Honourable Gentleman in this House. In fact, I've had the Minister for the Environment advise me of the existence of this contract during the past 48 hours for the purpose of the compilation of the answer for the House.
So if I understand the Chief Minister's answer, he is saying that his knowledge about these contracts was only acquired after I tabled these questions. That's what he's saying.
Mr. Speaker, that is correct in the context of all of the answers that I have provided him of contracts which 36 North has entered into with the government.
Before the Chief Minister, we've come to the end of the question and answer session. Before the Chief Minister tables the answers to written questions, I believe the Honourable Professor Cortes wanted to speak regarding question 544, because he had some amendments to the attachments.
No problem, it's just a second. Yes, Mr. Speaker, thank you very much. I have, apart from in question 544, I did write to the Honourable Edwin Reyes with some clarification on 539, but there were merely clarification. In respect to 544, which was related to the amount of debt owed by students, there have been two sums which were inordinately high, and they were picked up. Once read £133,375, another £159,104. Those were typographical errors. Entry number 89 should have read £13,375.40, and entry number 161 should have read £15,904.80. I apologize for the typographical error, but I've already clarified that in an exchange of emails. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I will ensure that the information is recorded, the correct information recorded in Hansard.
Mr. Speaker, can I also clarify? I've had confirmation from my office that... just get this right. In relation to question 850, the relevant identifier for the Guardia Civil launch is S21.
Answers to written questions, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to table the answers.
I have the honour to table the answers to written questions W87 through W118. Mr. Speaker, believe it or not, this session, I think, started some time last year when we could not imagine the winter that was to come. But now, in the early days of spring, it gives me great pleasure to utter the words that I move that the House should now adjourn, sine die.
Before I put the adjournment, or propose the adjournment, as honourable members are aware, it is a requirement under Section 69(1) of the Constitution that the estimates of expenditure for the next financial year be circulated to honourable members on a confidential basis not later than the 30th of April. Since the House is now not scheduled to meet until May, I am proposing that the provisions of the Constitution will be deemed to have been met if the estimates are circulated to all honourable members before the end of April. This is what we have been doing for the last few years, so I propose that it should be done, should be the case again for this year. Is that agreed? I now propose the question, which is that this House do now adjourn sine die. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn sine die. Those in favour...
aye.
Those against, pass. This House will now adjourn. Sine die.